All right. So, first things first. I didn't get to finish the grading, so I'll have it for you next week. I apologize for that. It's not like me. Second thing, consent. Any questions about the consent exercise? You had raised some questions about the consent exercise. So, last week when I said, let me see if I get them right. It's due on April 9th, I think?
Okay.
So, you have, is that when I said? It's in the, it's in the syllabus. It's in the syllabus. I think it says. I don't have it. Yeah, the 9th. That's 3 weeks from now? 3 weeks from now. So I said that I wanted you to give me a list of sources, which means like URLs of websites and stuff like that that you've used. But within the document itself, you don't need to put references. So you don't have to give me, like, if you use a paragraph that you liked, you don't have to put it in quotes and give me and cite it. Consent forms are, technically, you know, if somebody writes a consent form, it's copyrighted. You don't have to copyright it. I mean, you don't have to do anything. You own the copyright to it. But the language is shared, and it's pretty much made available freely. Of course, pharma would probably take an objection to what I just said. But if you can find it online, then I don't mind you using it or paraphrasing it heavily. So, I mean, if you find something that you like and it's, you know, written at a simplistic level, and like. Any questions about that? And if you have, anybody needs help on how to do the word, the grade level, just let me know. Just email me and I can respond. Any other questions? All right. So now we're into human subjects. We started with consent last week. And tonight I wanted to kind of dig into the history. And there's two threads, and I've actually got two separate presentations here. And there's two main points. The first main point is that all the regulations and consent and IRBs and everything else that we have about human subjects emerges from kind of revealed bad events. Right. And we're going to I'll review those revealed bad events in some detail for you in the next hour. The second thread, which we'll hit up in the second set of slides, is that most of the time these bad events involve really vulnerable people. Right? I mean, they just kind of came down. I mean, how much research was done in asylums, in the schools for the mentally infirm and the like is just mind-boggling. And so we have special concerns about people who are vulnerable, and I'll kind of lead us through a discussion of vulnerability. And that'll be me. All right. So let's start in the beginning. Okay, with history, which leads us to Belmont Court and IRBs, etc. Okay. So what we find in the first point again is ethics and law is highly reactive to what I call seminal events. So let's relate back. And before, actually, I should say before the late 1800s, there were a couple of cases, a couple of things that were written. And if anybody actually read the Howard Jones article, he refers to some stuff that happened earlier on. And there were some references to the need to get consent, and basically kind of like common law. If you did something that was off normal, and I talked about this with consent, you should get consent from people to do that. But there are really no codes, especially international codes, that kind of like dictated how to do research on people. One of the early things that was written was Claude Bernard had written a book in 1865, I believe, on a called Experimental Medicine. I have the book if anybody wants to see it. But he basically said that if his tripartite test was that if research was at all dangerous to people, with no prospect of benefit, then it shouldn't be done. If it was potentially beneficial, but it had no risks, then you could do it. And if it was potentially beneficial, then you had an obligation to do it. And that was Claude Bernard. This theme that if it's at all dangerous, you shouldn't do it, reemerges later on, especially in the early codes, with the idea as soon as they started kind of getting into consent, one of the immediate concerns was people who couldn't consent. In fact, in the Prussian regulations, written up here in 1900, they literally said you shouldn't do research. If somebody's incapable of consent, you should not be doing research, especially non-therapeutic research, research that doesn't hold out a prospect or an expectation of benefiting someone. So that's kind of, that emerges, and you still hear it. In fact, the clown who, the wasn't a clown. The lawyer who represented Jesse Gelsinger against Penn was on. He would get up and say that you shouldn't do phase one trials in healthy people. It's like, okay, then who are you going to do it in? But he really kind of took this idea to heart. So it does emerge every now and then, but that's not our current regulations. And there was earlier studies also of research that went on, and oftentimes it did involve really vulnerable people. Things that come to mind include Edward Jenner, who inoculated his son and some son's friends with cowpox, hoping to create immunity to smallpox, which worked. There was a famous case, made even more famous recently by Jason Karlowitz, who's faculty here, about the case of Alexis St. Martin, who was a Canadian fur trapper who took in 1923, I believe it was, he was shot in the side, an accidental shotgun blast, shot in this side. And it created a fistula. The doctor basically nursed him back to health. Everybody thought the kid would die. And he nursed him back to health, and then it created a fistula, an opening into his stomach on the outside. It ultimately got covered up with a flap of skin, but through which Dr. Beaumont could kind of like stick food. He'd stick various things into the stomach, and he would draw off the juices of the stomach, the gastric juices. And he wasn't really a scientist. He was trained as a surgeon during the war, so he really wasn't trained in how to do good research. Even though he thought, according to Jason's book, he thought that he deserved better. But he had this crazy relationship with this patient who became indebted to him in a very real way and was tithed to him for years. And finally, at one point, he escaped. Alexis St. Martin escaped and went back to Canada and got married and had two children. And still, Beaumont was trying to lure him back in. And apparently, at one point, he dispatched the police to arrest him and prevent him from going home. So you know, that's somewhat problematic when you're talking about a research subject. And their relationship was more complex, which was really problematic. Anyway, the first case that really kind of raised a public outcry was in 1898. It was research and a public outcry over the work being done by Albert Neisser. Anybody know who Albert Neisser was offhand? He discovered gonorrhea, gonococcus. Cause of gonorrhea. He was doing research on gonorrhea and syphilis, and he was infecting patients, most of whom were prostitutes in Breslau. And his basic justification is he was trying to find out whether or not it could how are these diseases communicated. He basically kind of fell back on the fact that they were prostitutes, and therefore they didn't probably get the disease from his experimentation, but from their profession. Anyway, there was a public outcry, and newspapers were all over this, leading one of the administrators, to issue a ruling to hospitals, basically saying you can't do this, you can't do research on children or those who are incapable of consent. And basically saying you have to give consent to people, and if they're incapable of consent, you can't do this to them at all. And I'm going to bounce around a little bit here in this presentation, but it's the only way to do it because there's a timeline. So that's kind of the first case, real big public outcry, and a rule as a result. In 1906, we end up with in the United States coming across the pond, we get the Pure Food and Drug Act, which was a reaction to public outcries about companies selling snake oil, essentially, in interstate commerce. People making all kinds of false claims about the therapeutic efficacy of various things, potions and that they were selling, some of which were dangerous. And actually, if you look online, you can see some of the stuff that was being pawned off. It's pretty outrageous. But the 1906 drug was actually just a truthful labeling law. It basically said you have to be truthful. You can't make claims that you don't have evidence of. And you have to be truthful, especially about the content of these things. And this is for sale in interstate commerce. So within our federal system, Congress only has the authority to kind of regulate interstate commerce, not within state commerce, intrastate commerce, intrastate commerce. So that's still being debated nowadays. And this becomes relevant later because of the limitations on what powers this law actually
created.
Right, we roll into the 20s. Not much was happening, especially because of the war. Not a lot of activity. In the mid-20s, I think it was around 27 or so, it was in Germany again. It was a Lübeck, the BCG TB vaccine tragedy. It was essentially a vaccine that was released into the public and given to children that was contaminated and killed, I believe, just short of 200 children. There was a public outcry about that. There was still lingering concern about other kinds of experimentation that was being done. And it led to German regulations in 1931 of innovative medical care. And basically kind of these regulations define innovative care. They basically said that if you're doing something that's non-therapeutic, you can only do it with consent of someone, which means you can't do it on children or mentally infirm. And if you do have therapeutic intent, if it has a potential for actually helping somebody, then you still need to get consent of the subject or the subject's surrogate. That was applied across Germany. Which, again, this becomes interesting because, of course, this is where the Nazi camps were and the doctors, which came up later. Back on this side of the pond in 1938, we had the elixir of sulfanilamide case. Sulfanilamide had been shown to be an effective antibiotic, and it was marketed by Massengill. It was a powder. It was very difficult to put into a liquid form. But a chemist, because they wanted to put it into liquid so it could be given to children, so a chemist in the bowels of Massengill used something called ethylene diglycol, which is apparently one molecule off of automobile antifreeze, which is also highly known. It was highly known from the 20s to be highly nephrotoxic. It would cause kidney failure. This chemist didn't know that, apparently. Anyway, they kind of mixed it up. It went into solution pretty nicely. I think it was strawberry flavor or cherry flavor. They kind of tested it for flavoring. They didn't test it for anything else. And they released it into the marketplace. Within a couple of weeks, the FDA started getting notices. And they were basically, across from the newspapers across the country, there were reports of children dying from this. And apparently the model was that if a child took it, and they'd get sick. If the parents gave them another dose, they'd probably die. At the end of the day, I think 106 children died. But if the parents stopped, then the kid might just have a transient problem and recover. The FDA looked into it. The FDA had no jurisdiction, really, except for the fact that it was called an elixir. And an elixir means that it uses alcohol as the diluent. Thank you. And this obviously didn't use alcohol as the diluent, so they had authority then to kind of pull the stuff off the shelves. The chemist committed suicide. Anyway, the public outcry of this led Congress to act and to pass the first Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act, which required safety testing of new drugs before they were released into the marketplace. All right, back over, meanwhile, over across the pond, war's going on. At the end of the war, the doctors who were performing experiments in the camps were put on trial. There were various war crimes trials. The doctors was the first trial. There were 23 doctors who were put in the dock, and the reason there were 23 of them is because that's the number of seats that were in the box. I believe it was in the jury box where they sat them. They were tried by American doctors. They had American defense lawyers. They had there were American experts for both sides. There were also German experts on the other side. And the doctors at the end of the day, I forget, more than a dozen of them were convicted, and I believe seven were hung. And part of the judge's final decision was what the rule is. It's become known as the Nuremberg Code. It was issued as part it was part of the final decision. So this rule didn't kind of exist beforehand. The rule was somewhat drafted by Andrew Ivey, who was an expert for the prosecution. And there was some evidence, and Jonathan Moreno has documented that he probably perjured himself, and because he was put on a stand and the defense asked him if he ever conducted research in prisoners and did he get consent from everybody and blah, blah, blah. And he probably lied to some extent to kind of cover himself. Anyway, the idea there is kind of a fairness problem here in the sense that these judges didn't. I mean, the judges made the rule and then held these people responsible for violating it, and that's kind of a violation of due process. Nonetheless, the doctors weren't really charged under for violation of this regulation. They were basically charged for crimes against humanity, and you know, some of the things that they did, they were murdering people. Committing really atrocious acts upon people. I won't go into the details. You've got the readings in front of you. If you want to discuss any of it, we can. The defense put on a very good defense. They basically pulled out. In fact, there was an expert report that culled from the literature, including American literature, I think around 600 examples of research done without consent on prisoners and the like, done here in the United States and elsewhere. It was a very good defense in a sense. So these, you know, we didn't do anything differently. Of course, you know, killing people and in the ways they treated people, I don't think the literature really supported what their arguments were. But the idea that you didn't have to get consent from people and that you couldn't do research on prisoners was really not supported by past practices. But what were the arguments made? Anybody know? What would you argue?
I think for those people.
For the doctors, if you were the defense, how would you, besides trying to show that everybody's doing it, which is only partially true, what else could you argue?
Well, in a war, different rules apply, and this is an attempt to really help develop cures for things that could be arising in the course of war.
Sure. So the yellow fever experiments, and the yellow fever was a problem for soldiers going into Russia. The freezing experiments, they had, you know, pilots would get shot down in the North Sea and they'd wind up in the water. They were trying to develop methods to save that. In fact, one of the big things they developed was, what they found out from these experiments was that keeping somebody's head out of the water substantially increases their survival time. And it led to the development of, which we still use today, the inflatable, what do you call them, vests that keep people's heads out of the water. So.
But these people, it seemed that most of the things they were charged to, that they did the experiment which was non-therapeutic.
It was not.
They were not of medical importance. You find that it was like for what they wanted to know what will happen, like injecting human being with the gasoline.
Right.
Forcing somebody to take poison, mm-hmm. How somebody die when take poison, which was just for curiosity, not here.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of it was driven by the war effort. Some of it was just, you know, Mengele was just nuts. But and the twins experiments and stuff were just kind of over the top. But another justification was that these people were going to die anyway. Right. So they're not really they're being sacrificed, they're being used in a way that you try to learn something from them, and no harm, no foul kind of thing. It really didn't go. Anyway, those arguments weren't. But you actually hear the kind of consequentialist arguments made today. Right? Sometimes, I mean, we still come down to, you know, the ends justify the means to a certain extent. We want, I mean, some research, there is a research imperative. We want to do research, and sometimes things, you know, privacy, for instance, privacy, the epidemiologists are very, very pragmatic and very consequentialist. The utility of the research that they're going to do and the violation of privacy is minimal, blah, blah, blah. They're responsible, they don't need to get consent, blah, blah, blah. Okay. All right. Any questions about that? All right. Another example of this. So in some sense, what happens here is the code was issued by that court. And the code was issued by a military court. And as such, it has some kind of effect within the military. It is binding upon the military. And the military's response was to basically concede that all research that the military was going to be doing in the future had to comply with the code. And that memo that basically said that was stamped top secret, top secret. Right? So anybody who actually knew about it, well, I mean, it was a secret. You couldn't even know about it, and much less how could you comply if it couldn't be really broadcast. So the code was really problematic. That said, the memo was stamped top secret, but the code wasn't. The code was published by Andrew Ivey and JAMA, I think, in 1947. So people knew about the code, but especially for organized medicine and people who were moving and doing research, it was, you know, this is, doesn't apply to good medicine. Right? This is done for a bunch of Nazi murderers. Right? It doesn't really apply to what we're doing. And in some sense, though, there was a rich history of getting consent from people. If you look back, in fact, at the turn of the century, which I kind of skip in my history here, there's the yellow fever experiments, which was being done by the U.S. military in Cuba. And Walter Reed, and they had a consent form for those experiments. And I don't know if anybody got a chance to kind of go off to the University of Virginia website. Did anybody do that? It's on the supplemental readings for this week. But there's a link to the University of Virginia libraries, which have a whole web page dedicated to the yellow fever experiments. They had a consent form. The biggest problem with that study was perhaps that you're getting really poor people from, you know, people from Cuba who were eligible to participate in the research. It held out, I think it was $100 gold coin for participation, $100 gold coin if you contracted yellow fever by being bit by a mosquito, and if you died, then your loved ones would get the $200. Somewhat problematic, but the consent was actually you could die. You could contract yellow fever and you could die. There were also quotes from other researchers around the turn of the century that said consent is, you know, you can't do this without consent, right? You had the Prussian regulations. You also had just some more general kind of awareness that consent mattered, right? Nonetheless, you know, in some sense, you know, you can make an argument maybe that the Nuremberg Code, because it was promulgated under such strange circumstances, it was easy for researchers in the 50s and 60s to discount and say, we don't need to do this. And this is, I think, it's an argument that Henry Beecher later made, which we can take up in a couple minutes. All right, anyway, so the code was there. There was research in the 50s that was ongoing, which isn't really mentioned here. The military and the CIA, for instance, were doing various studies. The military was looking at what later became known as the human radiation experiments. They were trying to find out how toxic plutonium and strontium and all these heavy metals, radioactive heavy metals, are. And the experiments included kind of injecting very high doses of plutonium into sick patients and watching what happened without consent. On the CIA side, there was the MK Ultra, which I'll talk about a little bit in the next presentation. MK Ultra was kind of a mind control, looking for ways to kind of control people. The CIA was apparently giving LSD to people unsuspecting without their knowledge. All of the records, which there were hearings called the Church Commission in the 70s in Congress, and the CIA by then had destroyed substantially all of their records, which is really nice. Let's see. Oh, anyway, it's a more mundane topic. 1954, there were revelations about the Wichita Jury Study. This is a social science study done by people at the University of Chicago, wherein they went in and, with the permission of the court, but unbeknownst to the jurors, they surreptitiously taped 6 criminal juries. And then, of course, as the good social scientists, they came out and they kind of went out and they published their results and went out and disseminated the results and findings. And there was suddenly the press caught on. There was a large public outcry about the violation of the sanctity of the jury box. And I believe at the end of the day, more than 30 states passed laws prohibiting the taping of juries. So again, you had this kind of thing that, from a social science perspective, no harm, no foul. You're just kind of going in, and the juries don't know you're taping. You don't know who the people in the jury room are. You've got permission of the courts. Where's the harm? Right? Nonetheless, there was still this public sense that the jury room is sacrosanct. You can't talk it. You can't do this. You can't invade the secrecy of that. Even though, especially after the OJ trial, we know that you can come out as a juror. You can come out and blab your head off. You can write a book about your experience, and that's okay. But surreptitious taping is not acceptable. Anyway, this revelation also led to publication of the making of the movie 12 Angry Men. don't know if anybody's ever seen the movie. It's a very good, really classic movie, and it's basically a criminal jury, and there's some juror misconduct that goes on in the jury, but of course, unless you were taping it, you'd never know that. All right, rolling ahead. In 1962 was revelations about the thalidomide tragedy. So thalidomide still is, it's a drug, and at the time it was used for sedation, and it was in particular given to pregnant women for pregnancy sedation, sleeping pill basically, and it causes thacamelia, which is short flipper-like appendages, feet or arms and legs. There was an analyst in the bowels of the FDA that kept the drug from ever being licensed in the United States. I think it was a she, or he with a she's name, just didn't trust the data on this and kind of kept it from being licensed. But it was in use in Europe. In fact, the only cases that happened in the United States were essentially people who had gone to Europe and brought back some and taken the drug. And anyway, there was a public outcry about this. There was everybody kind of realized that the old 1938 rules didn't require that really complex animal testing, especially for teratogenicity or monster causing, in utero kind of effects of drugs. And so the 1962 amendments of the FFDCA, which I think was 63, gave us more extensive animal testing, but also required what we currently have is the proof for drugs, which is that we prove that a drug is efficacious before it can be marketed. And it's always been interesting to me is like, how did the proof of efficacy get into the mix when what you were concerned about and what the case was that we weren't doing adequate safety testing. So why didn't the rule just kind of come out and say, well, you should be doing much more in-depth in safety testing? I'm not sure what the answer is. But anyway, as a result, it kind of this gave us our current regulatory regime of requiring phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 testing of new drugs. Neither one of these drugs, the 38 amendments or 62 amendments, regulated devices. Right? If anybody does read Howard Jones, I do suggest you read the Howard Jones article. If you didn't, it's a good summary. But he actually suggested the 38 amendment regulated devices, and it doesn't. All right, in 64, so as you move into the 60s, there was a lot happening. There was a lot happening culturally as well, especially in the United States. There was a growth of a consumer movement, and in some sense, if you read Jonas's piece about how do we justify doing research on people, I mean, it very much reflects the 60s and the growth of that movement. But there were a bunch of revelations in the early 60s that changed things. One thing that happened in 64 was the first declaration by the World Medical Association and the first declaration of Helsinki. And I think the declaration resulted, there had been discussions throughout the 50s by the World Medical Association for the need for some kind of regulation. There was concern within the medical community that the only set of rules out there was the Nuremberg Code, and that really didn't apply to them. So they felt that there was this need for some definitive statement of what the ethics of doing research on human subjects was. So the declaration was issued. It basically called for two things, which we'll see over and over again. One was kind of peer review, that somebody oversee research, make sure that it's ethical to do, and getting consent from capacitated subjects. The first issue in 64 also had a strange provision, what's called a therapeutic privilege, which is if the doctor felt that the research participation would be in the subject's best interest, and if he or she felt that getting consent would lead to a bad decision or it would be otherwise inimical to the person's good judgment or health, that he or she could withhold information. That provision has subsequently been stricken from the declaration. So there's this old standing thing in medicine that if you tell somebody something, something's likely. It's always been a criticism of informed consent. Well, if I mention that this could happen, it's more likely that it will happen, or the patient's, this idea that it would be inimical to the patient's therapeutic course to tell them something that's bad, potentially bad. Anyway, that's Helsinki. Also in 64, revelations about Stanley Milgram's experiments. I'll probably later in the semester I'll show you the video on Stanley Milgram. Anybody ever know who Stanley Milgram is? No? Yes? One? Two? Okay, so three. So Milgram was I guess that he's no longer with us, I don't believe. But he was a social psychologist at Yale. His experiments involved basically advertising the newspaper for people to come in, and he was paying them, I think, $5 or $7 to go through an experiment. The experimental design was that it was supposedly a learning experiment wherein someone was situated either where they were supposedly randomly selected to either be the learner or the teacher. All the subjects were teachers. There was a confederate who was always the learner. And I'll show you the video in a couple of weeks, and it's quite a shocking video, to be frank. But it's essentially the idea was that shocks could be used to reinforce learning. Okay? They weren't real shocks, but the subjects, of course, didn't know that. And the question was, is how big a shock would people give, given the fact that there's a researcher telling you there that, quote, the study requires that you continue. In a survey of people, a survey of psychologists, the psychologist basically said fewer than 1 in 100 people would go all the way to end, which are kind of like really, really supposedly dangerous shocks. When his big core condition, when the learner is behind a wall speaking through a speaker, and when this learner stops responding, I forget it, around 300 volt shocks, and it goes up to 450 and then XXX, and stops responding, that 70% of subjects went all of the way. And he then modified his protocol, which you'll see in the video in a couple of weeks, to kind of respond to criticism of the core condition. But under all conditions, he always got a substantial number of people, many more than you'd expect, to kind of like really deliver substantial shocks to people, because they think they're supposed to. So it's an obedience to authority study, and it has to do with the distance of the subjects that were supposedly receiving the shocks and the distance of the authority and how authoritative that power, the person of power is in the setting, has an effect on how likely those subjects are going to go. If you think about the 60s, also in this country, it's a political thing, and you know, the social psychologist, you'd expect it, but the bigger statement was about totalitarian states and their ability to control people, and he very rapidly jumps from his little experiment to the social implications of the experiment. Okay, in 64, there was also the revelations about the Jewish chronic disease hospital case. So the case in which a researcher from Memorial Sloan Kettering, cancer researcher, at the time, I believe there was a sense that cancer was, what's the word? There were some theories about how cancer was communicated, and the defenses that bodies would amount to cancer. And what this guy did is he went over it with permission of the hospital administrator, who was a physician, at the Jewish Chronic Disease Hospital case, in a series, I believe, of 22 indwelling elderly patients, meaning they weren't going anywhere. He, under the ruse of doing a, quote, skin test, the physician injected a bolus of live cancer cells into the thigh under the skin. And then watched as the body mounted an immune defense against this invasion of these cells, and he'd kind of like measure the response over the course of a week or two. One of the patients actually died, I think, 2 or 3 days after the injection from a previously undiagnosed bladder cancer, but apparently that was just bad luck. There was no lawsuit over this. There was a public outcry. I'm not sure how the public found out about this. I don't think it was from the publication. There was an outcry, a public outcry. The state licensing board actually sanctioned the physician who did the research and the physician at the administrator at the hospital who let him in. Nonetheless, in 1966, that researcher was rewarded, if you will, by being elected president of the National Cancer, I forget what it was called, like ASCO, whatever it was called at the time, the American Society of Cancer Oncology. So within the science community, what he had done wasn't perceived half as bad as it had been by physicians and by the public. All right. All right, in 66, Everybody doing hanging in there? In 66, there are various things that happened. One was revelations about the Willowbrook hepatitis experiments. So Willowbrook was a Staten Island school for the severe mentally disabled. The Willowbrook suffered from about 400% overcrowding. Hepatitis, amongst other things, was endemic in the population. And instead of kind of curing it, right, going in and fixing the problem, a researcher named Krugman from NYU went in and studied it. He was allowed to build a research ward at the institution. Parents who were putting their severely disabled babies or children into this facility were offered the opportunity, instead of going into the general wards where they would obviously be infected through just from being exposed, they could be treated nicely and have a much better setting by being put into this ward where they would be systematically exposed to hepatitis. The research apparently was, I don't know if it was critical. People said that, you know, I mean, Krugman is credited with discovering hepatitis and discriminating hepatitis A from hepatitis B, but other people said that he wasn't first, that other people were doing other research under less extreme circumstances and found the same thing. The big problems here, one is the extremely vulnerable population, the second is that it's extremely coercive. To offer parents, you know, it's basically, well, you can do this, or your children can be really terribly off, right? Because the kids were not in the facility and offered something that's better, where they'd be the same, be as well off as they were before, but they were actually being threatened with something that was much worse than research participation if they didn't participate. All right. Also in 66, in July, I believe, was an article that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, which you have in your readings. So Henry Beecher, I believe, is a professor of anesthesiology at Harvard. And what he had done is he went through, I think, the five leading biomedical journals, and he culled out a series of papers that had been published that he thought that had, it was actually, he culled out around 50 studies. His article, I believe, addressed 23 of them, 22 or 20, 22?
22.
22 articles that he thought were particularly problematic. They involved essentially all of them involved vulnerable subjects, which we'll talk about more. A lot of them were funded by the PhD, by public sources or by industry. They were run at leading institutions like Penn and University of Rochester and Harvard and all good places. They did include Willowbrook, and they did include the chronic Jewish disease hospital case. And he basically went through the very short little synopses of each case and what he thought was wrong with it. He didn't identify in the paper itself. It didn't identify which articles, which papers they were. But those have been subsequently revealed. And anyway, he basically said his conclusions were that what we need is ethical scientists. And he later, years later, he published a book, I believe in 1971, where he, by that time, had come around to the conclusion that you can't trust people, individual scientists, to make the right decisions, that we need some sort of systematic oversight of research. Just shortly before Beecher's article, I believe it was in April, the Public Health Service came out with new rules for the NIH Clinical Center and for the FDA, requiring IRBs, institutional review boards, and informed consent of human subjects. And so it was independent. Sometimes the fact that these both happened in 66 is interesting, and it was just kind of a stroke of luck. But it turned out that the PHS had been working on this, the Public Health Service had been working on this for some time, and that was the first set of regulations that really required consent in IRBs for research. So they required it, essentially, it was for internal research that the NIH was conducting, and for the FDA side of things, it was for anybody who was submitting research that would be in support of a license application for a new drug. Right. So this happened, and it's also interesting because apparently there were ethics kinds of committees at the NIH's clinical center, at least from the late 50s, but there's no documentation on these things. Turns out that there were research review committees at the NIH and at places like Penn and Harvard as well, but there's also no documentation of what these committees did. I don't know if they were like looking at resources, but to the extent that they did perform some sort of peer review, and it's always an open question, is what, did they get into the ethics of it? I mean, if you actually proposed something to your colleagues that was really kind of like, really kind of shocked the conscience, you could expect your colleagues to kind of like try to put a nix on it. Yeah. I thought you...
Yeah, so I was thinking, what is the boundary of this principles or regulation which you have put, or the power of it? Because as I was passing through the readings, I found that the Nuremberg Code was passed after the World War II, mm-hmm. and it was found that among the European countries, Germany was the one which was having a lot of regression, mm-hmm. but still doctors didn't consider that regression, they were accused of. But once again, features the same find that this institution that they are doing their studies without what informed consent, but still regulation were there, and the so.
I guess in some ways that was the problem was in a way if Nuremberg became the embodiment of what the ethics were. You know, people kind of knew about it, but it's very easy because of the way it was promulgated to these respect to these Nazi doctors. It was very easy for people to say it doesn't apply to us. Right? So, you know, we're good doctors, we're going to do... I mean, human radiation experiments, you literally have patients who are dying, and you're going in and injecting high doses of plutonium, and it's like, well, I know what's best for my patient. And it's like, okay. And under, how can you kind of justify that? Unless you're able to say, well, that rule, people said consent is necessary, but this, that doesn't apply to me. And they had to be able to... I mean, because there was this sense that you can't do this to people. And we knew this, and there are cases of people, you know, inoculating people. And there's, in fact, the studies that happened in Guatemala, there's already evidence that the people, the researchers, knew that they shouldn't be doing what they were doing there. They were trying to kind of cover it up. So there was a sense, I think there was a sense that people knew they should be getting consent, but it was a, you know, it's pragmatics, and it's like, and I think the fact that the code was easy to distance yourself from and say, this doesn't apply to us. Therefore, we're free to behave like how we believe others would be behaving. Okay. And I mean, it's not really clear. We can't go back and ask people, but it is clear that there were some statements of rules dating back more than 100 years, mm-hmm. and consent was always on the table, mm-hmm. and then at some point it became okay for people to kind of forget about consent, and we don't know why. Conjecture. All right, Beecher. So Beecher's study came out. Oh, yeah, anyway, so this policy, I was talking about the IRBs. When they weren't IRBs, they were research review committees. They existed at institutions. Really, no one knows what their purpose was and what their, you know, what they were doing regarding ethics. I always like to think that they maybe put constraints on people if they were trying to do something really outrageous. You don't know that. Especially because you have a tendency to think that doctors were thinking the same. They were raised in the same ethical system. I mean, in fact, people, when they talk about Neisser, apparently Albert Neisser was, I mean, his colleagues thought, well, he's a good doctor, he knows what he's doing, you know, this isn't a problem. And there was one doctor, I believe a psychiatrist, who really felt the opposite. And he wrote a book, I think it was written in 1906, it came out. It's only in German, it's never been translated into English, but it's Medical Ethics by I forget the guy's name. Moll, M-O-L-L. Anyway. Beecher also took some grief from his colleagues, right? It's like, why are you pointing this out as problems? Everybody does this kind of thing. Right? And he was like, well, we shouldn't be doing it this way. We should be improving the system. Also in 1966, on a different level, was the first step towards the current regulatory regime we have for animals.
I hope you're with some reference to the Life magazine pictorial essay on the concentration camp for dogs. Was that mentioned in the lecture? Did she mention that? So this was basically a picture essay of a bunch of dogs and like that were now in concentration camps. They were in animal research. The dogs, and some of the dogs basically had wound up there through pounds. So in 1966, this Life magazine article came out. It was fairly disturbing. I have it if anybody wants to see it. And it led to what later became the Animal Welfare Act. So the first iteration was called something else in 1966. It also led numerous states, I think, I don't know if there's any states that didn't pass such laws, but most, if not all, states have laws that prohibit the use of pound animals in research. So the animals have to be put down if they're not claimed in a particular time, but they can be used in research. All right. There was another famous study that was published, and I think in 1968, it's kind of interesting. There's a physician down in, down in Texas, where it was exactly will come to me. Gesundheit.
San Antonio.
San Antonio, yes, thank you. In San Antonio, who had an itinerant population of Mexican women, mostly Catholic, presumably, and he decided to do a little experiment himself without consent or with knowledge of the women on whether or not birth control pills worked. So he randomly assigned women to birth control or sugar pill. And lo and behold, 18% of those who got the sugar pill got pregnant. His justification in part was, well, you really didn't know if it would work in this way. And B, they could go and they can get an abortion if they got pregnant. Which was really, really crazy, especially in 1966. Abortion was only available in the United States legally in Colorado, and that only if you were white and upper class and related to the doctors on the committee that would review and approve the abortion. Not to mention the tradition from which these women were coming, abortion was probably illicit. So it was just totally wet. There was little that could be done about that. All right, 1971, we had revelations about the Lord Humphrey's tea room trade. Tea room trade is, I'm not going to give you a video about this. No, good. That was really disturbing, actually. So tea room trade is essentially anonymous sex in public places. Lord Humphrey's was a male, obviously male. He was an Episcopal priest who went back for his PhD in sociology, and his study was of these practices. He played a watch queen, so it was a non-participant observer. Well, he was kind of a participant observer in the sense that he was playing a role in public bathrooms in a park in a city where these practices were known to occur. And he documented the sociology of the room, essentially. Also, while he was playing watch queen, he also wound up writing down the license plate numbers of the people who were driving up and going into the bathroom. He wrote down their license plate numbers. And a year later, he disguised himself. I believe he grew a beard, glasses. He got himself named as the local investigator for a nationwide household survey. And then he added to the sample that he was supposed to do, he added the people that had been identified by a policeman friend from the license plate numbers. And he went and interviewed people. And what he found out about this deviant, this highly deviant behavior was that these people were like a swath of middle America. They were 50% of them were married, 50% of them were Catholic. It was just like you couldn't tell these people from other people on the street. And nonetheless, they were people who engaged in these practices. People criticized this. Why? There's no consent. People obviously didn't know they were being studied. There was a substantial risk to people. In fact, at one point, police would raid them. It was a known place. Police would raid it. He was arrested at least one time, and he didn't reveal who he was because it would reveal it to his subjects. Another time, kids showed up to go beat up the people in the room, and he took a beating as part of the environment. But anyway, he published his results. His dissertation came out. There was a large professional as well as public outcry about this. His department wound up getting closed down by the university. His advisor went to Harvard, so he wound up okay. Laud Humphreys wound up at the Claremont Schools in California, where he spent the rest of his career. And what else? What about the study? So the study is actually interesting. When we talk about social science studies in a couple of weeks, we'll talk about this because it was an interesting study to kind of think about what acceptable methods are and what was so bad about his methods compared to other methods. And also to contrast what he does with what the press does or what the police do. Because the police could do this. It might be entrapment, but the police could also put up video cameras. The police could do various things to observe as well. So why was what the social scientist did so bad when, in fact, the subjects didn't take a hit? It also speaks to the necessity to protect subjects. So like I said, he was arrested. And he was beat up. And at one point when the results came out, he was concerned that his records, which identified people, would be subpoenaed. So he sent his records out of state. He sent them off to a friend, which I always wondered whether or not that was adequate. Probably not, because they could have put him in jail until he produced the records. Of course, at some point, they might have just given up. They wouldn't leave him there until he rotted. But why didn't he destroy the records instead of just sending him out of state, which arguably he should have done? But ultimately, I think I hope that they were destroyed. All right, that's Hume, right? In 1972, we had the Stanford Prison Experiment revealed. Everybody's heard of this one, or anybody not heard of this? Okay, so there's a guy named Phil Zimbardo is a social psychologist at Stanford, and he was interested in prisons and prison acclimation, and especially of guards and prisoners. So he created a fake prison, and I've got the video on this too. So I'll squeeze it in, you know, between the last week of class and the next to last week of class. I'll fit these two videos in. But the Stanford Prison Experiment was really phenomenal. If anybody's not going to be here, let me know so I could talk about it now. Or otherwise, you just wait for the video because the video is really okay. You'll be here. Okay. All right. In 1973, there was a revelation about Rosenhan. The psychiatric hospital case was published in Science. Rosenhan basically got some fellows to go and to see a psychiatrist and basically say, all they said was, I'm hearing voices. They were all admitted, so clearly this wouldn't apply today, but they were all admitted to an inpatient psych ward, and as soon as they were admitted, they stopped saying that they were hearing voices, and they started taking notes. The staff basically said, well, taking notes is kind of like, that's kind of psychotic behavior, and it's paranoid behavior, and you know, kind of like totally put people into the realm of the environment in which they just found themselves. The patients understood, and they said, why are you here? Why are you taking notes? And the outcome of this was, in part, well, one flew over the cuckoo's nest. It's made in response to this. What else? All right, in 1973, we had also revelations about the misspelled Tuskegee syphilis study. The revelations of the study led to an immediate passage of the National Research Act. The National Research Act, among other things, created the National Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects, Biomedical and Behavioral Research. This commission met from between 1973 and 1979, really, I think it was 77. And they had commissioned kind of experts' reports on the performance of research. They ultimately issued 1979 here, the Belmont Report, which you have for reading for next week, I believe. The Belmont Report is this very short, 13-page, concise document that really captures how we morally justify doing research on human subjects. Behind the Belmont Report are appendices, lots of appendices. If anybody's interested, for instance, in pediatric research, there's a report on children's research in children that's very well done, very well thought through and stuff, and it's a very concise report. It basically captures the pros and cons of doing research in children. They had other reports on kind of how risky is research, on the role of consent in research, and anyway, if anybody's interested in kind of looking behind this, you can. All right. In 1974, in response to this, the Department of Health and Human Services kind of broadened their regulations requiring IRBs and informed consent, both again for FDA, but as well for NIH-funded research. This is for extramural research. Turns out that actually back in 1966, with this requirement for FDA, was the first creation of IRBs within institutions like Penn, UCSF, and other places, and also the beginning of performance of various sub-studies about institutional review boards. The first study was in 1967 at UCSF, and then there were several large studies in the late 60s and early 70s looking at, you know, across lots of researchers and lots of IRBs trying to find out what it is that these boards do. So I'll discuss those in the future. Anyway, so this rule predated our current set of rules, but likewise basically required institutional review boards for all research, federally funded research. All right, in 1976, we had the Dalkin-Shield case. Dalkin-Shield is a form of IUD, an intrauterine device. It had a string attached to it. There was wicking of bacteria up the string into the uterus, causing pelvic inflammatory disease. There was a lot of cases of women getting serious infections and becoming sterile because of this device. And somebody, I guess Congress finally woke up and realized that there's no regulation, no federal regulation of devices. So in 1976, they passed the medical device amendments to the FFDCA, giving us some regulatory structure, not as comprehensive as the drug side, but for medical devices. In 1979, the Belmont Report issued. So you'll read the Belmont Report for next week. And the Belmont Report essentially says that, you know, because the federal government is putting so much money into research, that there should be federal regulation of the ethics of human subjects research. As a consequence, in 1980, there was a draft rule promulgated. And in 1981, the week before Ronald Reagan took office, this rule was signed into effect. Ronald Reagan had been elected on an anti-big government. He was promising to shut down the Department of Commerce, for instance. So there was, the draft rule had been promulgated in 1980, they collected comments, and they wanted to get this thing signed into law before Reagan took office. So apparently they went to Secretary Schlesinger of HHS the week before, and he was like, "Well, have it on my desk tomorrow morning," which meant that they had some 50,000 comments that the administrators of HHS had to respond to by 9 o'clock the next morning. So everybody, apparently there was a big kind of like a overnight crush. Everybody kind of stayed up all night, like trying to write comments and summarize the comments that were received and write responses and all. And as a result, then the rule was signed into law the next morning. And if you actually read the commentary to the rule, it's in some places nonsensical, and that's had consequences, which I'll also talk about in the coming weeks. Next week, to be exact. All right. So that was signed into law in 1981. The rule was amended a couple of times through the 80s. And in 1989 or 1990, it was finally adopted by all of the federal agencies that perform or fund human subjects research, except for the FDA. The FDA has its own set of rules, which are essentially, they differ in a couple of little ways, but essentially the same. And anyway, because it was adopted by all these agencies, it became known as the Common Rule. Now, the agencies only signed on, and this is kind of important, they only signed, and we'll talk about it again next week, they only signed on to Subpart A. So Subpart A is the general rule. So when you look at the rules, there's Subpart A, which is the general rules for research. Subpart B is pregnant women. Subpart C is prisoners. And Subpart D is children. So some of the agencies have not signed on to parts B, C, and D, but only part A. Right? And when you interpret parts B, C, and D, so this is a reading for the next week, when you look at those subparts, They modify subpart A. So subpart A still applies, but then they have special provisions for those particularly vulnerable populations. All right. Let's see. In 1985, there was the Penn head trauma case and the Edward Tabb case. This guy, Edward Tabb, was at the University of Maryland. He performed research basically cutting nerves, I believe, in monkeys' arms and the like, and then he would watch how nerves grew back. And the Penn head trauma case was a guy named Generali here who was interested in head trauma, obviously, and had developed various devices for creating severe head trauma in monkeys and baboons. In 1985, there was a break-in, I believe, on Memorial Day. Apparently, it was an inside job. PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, broke into the video. You might have heard about this in the animals lecture, but they broke in, stole 60 hours worth of videotapes, from which 25 minutes was culled, played on the floor of Congress, and distributed widely, showing. Did you guys watch the video?
Yeah,
I
watched it.
Did you all stay? Hardcore. No? Okay. I see a couple. Okay. Can't blame you. Anyway, that video was shown in the halls of Congress, and Congress responded by passing the 1985 amendments to the Animal Welfare Act. Those amendments gave us our current regulatory structure on animals, which is essentially IACUCS. We still don't get consent from animals. But because of that, I think in part because of that, we have very strict regulation of animals, much more strict than in humans. For instance, with animals, we kind of know how many big animals are used in research nationwide because they're reported, whereas humans, we have very little idea how many people are used in research. And IACUC, the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee, protocols are very specific about how many. You have to justify every single animal that you're going to use in your protocols. But I don't know if she also got into what happened subsequently. I think she did in her slides. But so when the regulations were written, when the statute was written into regulations, because Congress told them to rate it, the regulations excluded rats and mice. Did she talk about that? And there was a big lawsuit from 19, I guess it was decided in 1989, was settled in 1989 with, who is this? APHIS is what? Agriculture, I think, implements these rules. Is it HHS? I forget. But they basically said, yes, you're right. The statute says we have to regulate rats and mice. And therefore, we have to go back and we have to redo the regulations to put rats and mice back into the regulations because it's all mammals. And there was a move in Congress, and they actually defunded any effort to try to regulate rats and mice. So the rule exists, but there's no money to implement it, which is kind of funny. All right. And then finally, moving forward into the late 1990s, there was a lot of activity in the late 1990s by the old Office for Protection from Research Risks. There was a head of the office was named Gary Ellis, and he just started kind of going off and looking at institutions and shutting institutions down for kind of bad IRB practices. Some of those practices, for instance, Duke University had an IRB that would meet at lunchtime and once a month, and then Duke was doing pretty much the volume of research that Penn was doing, maybe 2,000 protocols per year, and the IRB would stay there until they were finished, which meant they stayed there through dinner. And somehow you have to assume that a protocol reviewed at 8 o'clock at night isn't getting the same thorough review as a protocol at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. But they shut them down, and within 3 days they'd negotiated kind of getting put back online. Because what does the shutdown mean? It means that the federal funding spigot has been turned off. And to institutions that get a couple $100 million a year in research funding, that's $1 million a day for a work day. So you get their attention very quickly. And Duke increased their budget from $300,000 to $1 million. Penn, after the Jesse Gelsinger case, which was in 1989, we increased the number of IRBs in the office budget from $350,000 to $1.3 million. So this time was a good time for IRBs. Also during this time, there was created early 2000s actually, was the AHRP, the Association for the Accreditation of Human Research Protection Programs. This rolls right off the tongue. which is seeks to accredit IRBs, has kind of highly proceduralized what it is that IRBs do. But it's all in response to the same set of concerns that was raised in the late 1990s.
It's expensive, too, right?
Yeah, the system is pretty expensive. Yeah, and people are still decrying what's happening. And we'll talk about this more because they're recently with the head of the Office for Human Research Protections and our new chairman were highly instrumental in writing what's called an ANPRM, advance notice of proposed rulemaking to revise the common rule. And basically it looks like the feds are just, I mean, it really gets feds out in a lot of ways, of lots of types of research, which we can talk about next week. All right. I'm not going to cover this, because you're going to read the Belmont report this week. Right. The Belmont, it is important, though, kind of like, I guess I should talk about this because it's worth repeating. So the Belmont report, it's basically a statement of ethical principles and guidelines that should assist in resolving dilemmas, right? And this is things that everybody hears about. It's these three principles, respect for persons, beneficence, and justice. And these things come up over and over again. They don't necessarily help resolve all dilemmas because they sometimes conflict. Right. But anyway, one of the things, and this comes out of the history, which I'll hit in the next set of slides, is this issue about justice and choice of subjects. Very important. And we have a tendency, and this is the history, we have a tendency to kind of pick on people who are incapable of protecting themselves. So, any questions about this?
Oh, I just tried the link and it didn't work.
Which link?
So the Belmont report from Blackboard?
Yes. I just sent it.
Yes.
Okay. I have it. I can send it around. I'll put it up there. It's also HHS.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's been changed. It's been updated. Sorry about that. So can you do me a favor back there? There's another... If you
can figure out how you can do that.
So some of this will be repetitive. So anybody want to take a break? I'm talking too much. Can we take 5 minutes?
Thank you.